Time now for our weekly chat with the experts at ETF.com, the world's leading independent authority on ETFs.
I ran the numbers again for the cheapest ESG ETF portfolio. These are good numbers. They're not marijuana good, but they're pretty good. If you believe that it's going to save you in the apocalypse, you might want to consider something else.
Laura, how's everything going? Did I see correctly that you are currently under quarantine with your kids?
Yes, actually, we are quarantined out of an abundance of caution because there was an outbreak at our kids' day camp. So we are fine. Everybody's healthy. Nobody's showing any symptoms. And it doesn't seem like we have been exposed. So, you know, knock on wood.
How much longer do you have to go? Was it 14 days?
Yes, yes. Through the end of the week, with luck, hopefully we will be able to get back to normal at the beginning of next week. But, you know, anything could happen at this point.
No doubt. So. Well, I wish you the best of luck with that experience. Okay, so let's start with what is always our favorite topic, ESG. I continue to see all kinds of headlines around record inflows into ESG ETFs. And look, I know that's true, that's factual, but you also know I can't help myself. And so I looked, this appears to be primarily driven by one ETF issuer, iShares. And my understanding is much of that is bring your own assets, right? It's iShares model portfolio allocations or a handful of larger institutional investors. I guess my question is, given all the ink spilled on record ESG flows, is this really that impressive so far this year? Should this be garnering the headlines?
Right. So I'm going to push back on this idea that BYOA, bring your own assets, that doesn't matter or it isn't impressive. And for two reasons. So the first reason is that we don't discount BYOA assets for other products, right? When JP Morgan was pumping billions into its own beta builder products last year, nobody just waved their hands and said, oh, it doesn't count. It's just their own, you know, their own thing. So of course it counted. Assets are assets, and it counts because the more assets you have in a fund, the more likely you're going to attract more assets in an organic way. And we are starting to see that happen with some of the iShares products in small ways. They are starting to gain a little bit more momentum from an organic growth perspective. Some of the ones like ESGU and ESGD and so on. The second reason I'm going to push back is because it's not entirely clear to me that the record flows are entirely and wholly the result of BlackRock just dumping cash into its own funds. You know, the iShares flows, as you say, they are large. They are considerable. Out of the $16 billion that have gone into ESG funds this year, $12 billion of it have gone into iShares funds. So, but that's still $4 billion that's going into other funds. And I think that the flows are so large in the iShares space that it's kind of masking that there's real organic growth going into these other funds. So, you know, backing up a second with some numbers, there is currently $38 billion invested in ESG ETFs. That's an enormous growth from last year, where we ended around the $19 billion mark. And we've seen, like I said, $16 billion of new net cash going into these funds. And that, to kind of put it in perspective, is more than the money we have seen going into leveraged and inverse ETFs and ETNs, which have been kind of the new hotness of 2020, right? Like with the Robinhood investor, and there's been a lot of ink spilled there too. So we've seen more money go into ESG than we have seen go into funds like TIVX and, you know, all those other fund leveraged funds. So you're right that BlackRock dominates the ESG ETF scene, but we're seeing strong growth in the Vanguard products, for example. They've seen $1.1 billion in new net cash come in to ESGV and VSGX. Those are their two ESG ETFs under the Vanguard brand. They're now solidly in the top 10 largest ESG ETFs. Same story is true for WisdomTree's XSOE. That's the X state-owned enterprises ETF. That's seen $644 million go in, and which was sort of a surprise to me. Nuveen's NULV, which is their ESG value ETF, that's seen 360 million go in as well. That's a pretty good chunk of change for them. So the one thing I want to point out about all of these funds is that they all started the year relatively cheap and relatively large, right? So it's axiomatic that the largest ETFs, the cheapest ETFs, and the largest cheapest ETFs tend to be the ones that get the most new cash from investors. We've seen that play out not just in the ESG space, but all over the industry. And all of these top 10 ESG ETF flows getters are all relatively very cheap at 25 basis points or less. So, you know, to me, 2020 is a story as much about cost and, I guess, scale, you know, the ability to just scale up quickly and efficiently, to try new products, to see which ones will stick, to offer these products for relatively low cost. These are the issuers that are seeing flows into their products. So,
yeah, and I'll add to that, the second most successful ETF launch this year is the iShares ESG MSCI EM, Emerging Markets Leaders ETF LDEM. That has about 620 million, which is really impressive. When we talk about BlackRock, one thing that seems crystal clear is iShares is positioning themselves as the ESG leader right now. I mean, look, they've come out and they publicly committed to this earlier in the year. You and I talked about that. I know they recently launched what they're calling an ESG advanced lineup. They also have the ESG aware lineup. So you have to think that if retail investor demand does continue picking up this truly organic demand, I would think iShares is pretty well positioned here. Would you agree with that?
I absolutely agree. And hey, I actually think I want to give credit where credit is due, that iShares is continuing to evolve their ESG lineup. Like you said, the advanced line of products that are coming out, those are, a newer take that have let me back up a sec. So there's the aware and there's the advanced, right? So the aware is kind of, those ETFs are kind of the ones we've already seen on the market thus far, ESGU, ESGD. They have, you know, a certain set of typical exclusionary screens, no alcohol, no gambling, no nuclear power, no, controversial weapons, that sort of thing. The advanced line, however, adds additional exclusionary restraints, such as no fossil fuel exposure, no private prisons exposure, no palm oil exposure. And they also try to go in their index construction for a best-in-class approach, which I think a lot of investors, we can talk about this more, but I think a lot of investors intuitively think that ESG ETFs do this, but they haven't up to this point. The new advanced line of ETFs will take only companies that rank at a certain point of the rating spectrum and above, you know, the average point and above. So they really are going for that best in class approach. And, you know, these are things that I've heard advisors and investors ding the current lineup of ESG ETFs for. So, you know, good on iShares for listening to feedback and trying to evolve their products so that they're making products that people want.
Well, I saw that they launched some asset allocation ETFs in the ESG space as well. For example, the iShares ESG Aware Conservative Allocation ETF, the ticker is EAOK. So basically these own other iShares ESG ETFs. And of course, one of the ways they're able to do this, especially when you think about a conservative allocation, is iShares also has ESG bond ETFs. And I know you wrote about that maybe last week or the week prior, but those have seen decent flows as well.
They have. And so the thing about those asset allocation ETFs, they're actually patterned after an existing family of asset allocation ETFs in the iShares lineup. And those funds have not really seen much success. They're, you know, maybe a couple hundred million and, you know, across them, across the four of them. And there's, you know, a conservative allocation and an aggressive allocation and a growth allocation. And none of them have seen the sort of $1 billion inflows that we sort of kind of expect to see from a BlackRock fund. So I'm curious to see if an ESG tilt is going to change the fortunes of, you know, these particular asset allocation ETFs if they're going to find a little bit more success than, you know, the vanilla versions.
Yeah, well, I think the asset allocation ETFs as a whole, they're just a tough sell, I think, particularly with the advisor community, because they don't want to have just one ETF on a client statement, right?
So even if they
are wonderful products and they do what they're supposed to, I just think that's one of the challenges. And if you think about asset allocation funds or target date funds, those are predominantly found in 401ks. And of course, we know while ETFs are making some inroads there, ETFs certainly aren't the vehicle of choice in 401ks. And so I think, you know, you're missing that opportunity to drive assets.
Yeah, no disagreement there.
Laura, before we move on, because I do want to get to a couple of other topics, everyone knows you and I can't talk ESG without at least a little friendly debate. And so I have to ask you about this this tweet that I sent a couple of weeks ago, which I know you saw because you quote tweeted me. I think you try to make me look like an idiot, which I don't need a whole lot of help with that. So,
oh, man, I didn't realize you were going to drag me in front of all of these listeners.
Well, OK, so the tweet that I sent noted the top five companies and the most popular ESG ETF, which happens to be the iShares ESG MSCI USA ETF, ticker symbol ESGU, which you mentioned earlier. The top five companies are Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, Facebook, and Google. And together, these represent like 21% of the ETF's exposure. And in my tweet, I was basically asking people if this aligns with their ESG goals. And I really was being serious here. I wasn't trying to troll, because I'm trying to better understand the ESG space. And you look at these holdings, these are obviously popular holdings in any U.S. equity ETF. And I know some would argue that a company like Facebook may not even be the best representation of ESG. And so, long story short, you responded that, let me read this. So, quote, since ESGU's goal is more to avoid the worst ESG offenders rather than to select ESG all-stars, then yes, this aligns with its stated goal. Now, you did also say, well, of course, investors think they're getting ESG all-stars in some of these ETFs, when maybe that may not be the case. Can you just elaborate on this? Because I do think this is what sort of gives ESG a bad name, that people look at this and say it's basically an index fund with a higher fee. And I realize that they may not understand what's going on here. That's why I'm asking the question, because I do think people who don't understand what's going on here, that's why you see ESG sort of drag through the mud at times.
It's a great question, and I'm glad you brought it up, because, you know, I've said it before that I tend to break ESG ETFs into two categories. There's the best in class ETFs and the best of the rest ETFs, right? So the best in class ones tend to be the thematic ones. It's, you know, a manager is using some methodology, some rules to pick the best matching stocks to some thematic concept, you know, your solar ETFs and so on. The best of the rest ETFs, those tend to be the market beta funds that are ranking potential constituents across ESG factors, then kicking out those lowest scoring stocks. So I think maybe it's easier to think of it in terms of a 7-point scale, right, for ESG scoring. There is a 7-point scale. It's letter grades. We're going to use numbers today, but, you know, 1 is the best and 7 is the worst. So these best of the rest funds, they are kicking out the 7s, maybe the 6s, and just investing as usual in the rest of the letter grades. Every new investor, every new ESG investor I speak to gets kind of confused about this. They think that an ETF who's just kicking out the worst performing stocks should also be inherently selecting for outperformance or higher ESG credentials or so on. And that's just not how it works. You can't get the performance of just the ones when all you're doing is excluding the 7s. You understand? It just doesn't work like that. So I think that's one reason why ESG investors who really believe in the potential of it, they should look at some of the smaller ESG funds out there that are really trying to isolate those ones and twos with their methodology. One of my favorite overlooked funds is CHGX. That's the ESG fund from Change Finance. It's very tiny in terms of assets, but it has probably some of the most stringent exclusionary screens in the industry. And I think this is the fund for the true ESG believer is this particular one.
Well, in a dovetail on what you were saying, there were actually some great responses to my tweet. And I want to read a couple of these because I think you'll appreciate them. One was from Tim Nash, and he said, I tend to differentiate doing less evil ESG ETFs from doing more good thematic ETFs. And he said, ESGU is very squarely an ETF that attempts to do less evil. From there, it's a range from a small step ESGU all the way to a big step in the right direction of CHGX, which you just mentioned, the Change Finance U.S. Large Cap Fossil Fuel Free ETF. So I thought that was a good way to put it. Another tweet that I appreciated was from Jake Radin. And he said, ESG is not some monolithic thing that is supposed to be one way and everyone agrees on it. How many definitions of value are there or quality? He said, this ETF is what you get when choosing diversified large mid beta based on third-party ESG scores. Nothing more, nothing less. And then I'll give you one more. This was from Mona Nakvi, who we've actually had on the podcast. She's with S&P Dow Jones Indices. She made a great point. She said, Facebook, the only reason it made it into ESGU is because its peer Twitter got excluded for not adhering to the UN Global Compact due to poor labor rights. So Facebook was selected to meet the index objective, going back to your point. And I also pulled one more stat. Just I think that this speaks to both the challenges, but also better understanding the space, which I'm really trying to do. You wrote a piece where you looked at the fossil fuel exposure in ESG ETFs. And you said the vast majority of equity ESG ETFs today, 83%, have some exposure to fossil fuel users and producers. And the reason for that is, you know, an energy company may rank poorly on environmental criteria, but maybe they have really high social or governance ranks. And so that gets them into some of these ETFs. All of this is to say that you do have to decide what it is you want in your portfolio. Are you just trying to, I'll go back to what Tim Nash said, do less evil, or are you trying to do more good? And there's a spectrum of ETFs that are going to range, you know, between those two.
I very much agree. And I want to actually pick up what Jake was saying too, about how this is really about third party rankings and how, you know, stocks align along those rankings. One of the complicating factors when you're talking about ESG is that not all companies, a lot of ESG reporting is based on self-reported data, and not all companies will fill out surveys or answer questions or report data in the same way. And so they just get kicked out of the potential universe of stocks because there's just not enough data to be able to say one way or another whether they're good or bad. So that is also a complicating factor here too.
No doubt. Okay, let's move on because I do want to get to the two other stories. Let's briefly talk actively managed ETFs. Of course, anyone who listens to this podcast, they know the first non-transparent ETFs began rolling out, what was that, a few months ago. And actually, did you see American Century launched two more last week that focus on ESG? So that's a combination of my two favorite topics, right? ESG and non-transparent. but last week, Bloomberg noted that so far in 2020, 68 active ETFs have been launched versus only 63 passive ones, which I think may surprise some people. What do you make of this? Just the number of active products now coming to market.
So the number, since then, there have been a few more launches, and now it's 140 ETPs all across the board, and 70 are active and 70 are passive. So we're at equal right now. But I think just the huge number of active launches, disproportionate to past years, part of it ties back to that BYOA trend that we were talking about earlier. You know, most of those issuers, asset managers who are pumping client money into their own ETFs, they have proprietary active strategies that have made them a lot of money in the past that they would like to continue having people invest in. And mutual funds are just a lost cause at this point. They are bleeding assets left and right. They are more, because they're more expensive, they're less tax efficient, and they kind of have a little bit of a stigma nowadays, I think. So, you know, these issuers decide to launch an ETF and fund it with their own money. You see everybody from First Trust to JP Morgan to PIMCO all bringing big money to the table this year into their own ETFs. And, you know, a lot of big asset managers known for their active strategies like American Century and Fidelity are venturing into active, you know, non-transparent active ETFs. So there's a trend of, I think, active managers wanting to just continue making money, and they realize that the writing's on the wall for mutual funds. But there are also, and I think this is maybe the more interesting bit, there are also boutique active managers that are seeing really big success this year. The ARK funds, ARKK, ARKW, ARKG, these have all seen a huge spike in year-to-date flows, billions of dollars going into each of these funds. And I think that speaks to the fact that there is a role for active management in a portfolio, as so long as that active management is demonstrably bringing something to the table. These funds from Kathy Wood's shop are just blowing things out of the water in terms of performance. They are really just top of the... Whenever you look at the performance charts for the year, it's always just cluttered with ARK funds, right? So when Kathy Wood and her team at ARK Invest have really built something special there, their active tech ETFs, their active genomics ETFs, you know, every issuer has a passive tech fund nowadays, and more have a passive healthcare ETF. But ARK's active funds are adding something special, and that something special is expertise, I think. They really have specialized expertise going into making these funds stand out on the marketplace. So I think what this trend of more and more active products being launched and gaining more assets than they ever have, I think there's still a lot of room for active investing in the ETF space, especially in sectors, thematic investing like we've seen with the ARK funds. If you get this specialized expertise from experts instead of just, you know, closet indexing or generalists or whatever, you could get a real opportunity for alpha. I could even see, you know, the case for it in impact investing, where you could, you know, I don't know, get really discreet or granular with security selection if you're talking about, not investing in muni bonds that are funding police departments. This is a real example. I've spoken to an advisor who is very involved in this sort of, racial justice investing. I could see a case for active management there. I think you asked the question of like whether we're going to continue seeing active management ETFs launch. And I think absolutely, because this is where the opportunity still lies ahead. You know, market, low cost market beta, that's kind of a solved problem at this point. But low cost active management that really adds something to the marketplace, I think there's some opportunity there.
Well, the other thing I'll add, and this isn't the most enlightening statement, I guess, but look, the plain vanilla beta is all spoken for, right? Just about every factor mm-hmm. or smart beta strategy seems spoken for. And so if you're looking for ways to make a splash, differentiate yourself, certainly active management is one way to do that. And the other thing, too, you mentioned making money. Obviously, that's a driver here. Like I checked. So the average fee for active ETFs launched this year is around 80 basis points, which obviously is a lot mm-hmm. higher than what the weighted average expense ratio is across the ETF land. So that's another factor here too, that this is a way where you're not, you know, slinging mud over a basis point or two, right? 3, 4, 5 mm-hmm. basis points. You can actually charge something much, much higher. And so that's clearly a driver as well. Laura, just a couple of minutes left. Let's touch on a piece you recently wrote on the number of exchange-traded products that have closed this year. So we were just talking about launches. Let's talk about closures, and in particular, mm-hmm. ETNs, exchange-traded notes. Now, this data, I'm sure, is a little stale. I pulled this. This was as of July 10th in the piece you wrote. You may have updated data now. But you said 173 ETFs had shut down, delisted, closed creations, or otherwise become unavailable to investors. And that included 50 ETNs, with the majority of those being leveraged or inverse products. In terms of ETF closures overall, do you see this as anything other than a maturing industry, just a normal pruning of products? And of course, we have the market environment playing a big role here too, right? Or do you think there's something more to it?
Honestly, I think it's mostly the market environment. I'm not entirely surprised that we've seen so many closures. And in fact, I think I'd be more surprised if there weren't a lot of closures. This year has been rough on everybody. It's tightened the conditions of profitability for a lot of these ETFs and these ETF companies. So many issuers are taking this as an opportunity to kind of cull their herds, adjust their lineup, and move away from the lowest performing funds. You mentioned the ETNs. Credit Suisse has been quietly getting out of the ETN business, just closing ETNs left and right. And a large reason of why they're doing this, and they've stated this in their press releases, is that they're trying to readjust their lineup and rethink their lineup. So I think a lot of issuers are kind of taking that same approach. Like, this is the time that we can kind of, maybe get rid of some of the more troublesome products or less profitable products for us.
As it stands now, there are around 120 ETNs still out there, and 55 mm-hmm. of those are leverage or inverse. What do you think the future of ETNs is? I said recently, I think these products will continue declining. Do you agree with that?
I don't know that I agree with that. ETNs have remained for years and years a niche product. And I think we're going to continue to see them be a niche product, but we still see ETNs launch. We've had 7 launch this year. It's not a lot, but it's not like, zero, right? We saw 21 launch last year. And most of those were leveraged and inverse. And that's, I think, the key here, because leveraged exposure is just easier to do in an ETN package than an ETF package, because an ETN doesn't have to hold a portfolio. It's just a debt note where the return is tied to, it's a number tied to an index versus an ETF, which has to, hold physical securities. So to do that leveraged exposure, it has to go to the derivatives market. And that is its own whole can of beans that needs to, be dealt with. So, it's easier in a lot of ways for the issuer to just focus on that number return and do it that way. So I think you're going to continue to see leveraged inverse ETNs come to market. I don't think the ETN is going the way of the dodo anytime soon. But, I titled my piece the leveraged and inverse ETN extinction for a reason, because, the dinosaurs went extinct, but in reality, they just evolved to birds, right? They changed form, they changed their purpose. And I think that's kind of what we might see here for ETNs. The market beta ETNs or the very narrow thematic exposure ETNs, I don't think those have too much of a shot. But maybe the leveraged and inverse ETNs.
You had a stat that really caught my attention. You said that 45% of ETNs offer some kind of leverage or inverse exposure compared to just 8% of ETFs. And obviously that gets back to what you were saying in terms of being perhaps a bit easier to get that leverage or inverse exposure in the ETN vehicle, because it's just a debt instrument mm-hmm. as opposed to having somebody go and manage a portfolio of that within the ETF wrapper. Laura, I'm glad we had a little more time than usual this week. We never have enough, but this was fantastic. Appreciate you joining me, and good luck with the kids in quarantine.
Thank you so much, and thanks for having me on.
Always. That was ETF.com's Laura Krieger.